Good morning. So I have to say that it feels both strange and exciting to be back here at Asbury in the church that shaped and formed me as an individual, but this time also as a preacher. I have had many experiences in this sanctuary. I can actually remember the first time that my family and I came here and worshiped back in 1998. Looking back, my guess is that Billy had waited until the last minute to write his sermon. And so, instead of the usual 15 to 20 minutes of preaching, Billy just got creative and threw a ball of yarn around the congregation, having members catch it and say something that they were thankful for, with most people saying, "I'm thankful for this congregation because." Sherry remembers this. So the purpose of this activity was to create a web of gratitude. While in Orthodox, that spirit of creativity impressed my family, and we kept coming back. At the age of 12, I was confirmed in this sanctuary, taking an important step in my faith journey. And I think that there's an embarrassing photo of me and the rest of us somewhere in one of the offices. Every Christmas Eve during my teen years, I donned a white leotard and a white skirt and danced to Go Tell It on the Mountain in this sanctuary, and Miss Gretchen is here today, I see. The theater opportunities were numerous here, and I was part of many productions and rehearsals. But in this sanctuary, I was part of the cast of Jesus Christ Superstar, in which I played a demon that followed Judas around, tormenting him until his bitter end. Yes, it was very inspirational to grow up at Asbury. And in what was probably my first sermon, 10 years ago, I stood in this same spot and preached the eulogy at my dad's memorial service. And that might have been the first time that I actually considered seminary. And also, while I didn't get married in this sanctuary, Billy did marry me and my husband Ian at our home church in Durham. And it was, suffice it to say, Asbury was definitely part of our service as Billy burst out into song from Pippin. And we had many of the members here were part of our special day. So, now you know as well as I do that there are many special things about Asbury. But growing up here is truly a unique experience. One thing that stands out to me is storytelling. Not just that at Asbury we tell stories through song and dance, but that this community honors the stories of the congregation, even if it is through the spiritual practice of throwing a ball of yarn. And I did consider bringing a ball of yarn and recreating that experience today, but that seemed too easy. And so when I was in seminary, people would always ask, "How do you get young people to stay in the church?" And I always thought, just tell the gospel, share the stories of Jesus in ways that are vibrant, life-giving, and fun. To me, it was simple, because that is the mode of learning that I had practiced, thanks to Asbury, from my early years on. Religions and religious communities are, among other things, sanctuaries for stories. From ancient stories to stories of current-day people to individual stories of people in this room, this community creates a sanctuary for stories to be told, heard, and held. This is in stark contrast with the mainstream world in which our stories are getting lost. The 24-hour news cycle and the advent of online advertising creates a pressure cooker in which stories have to be fast and cheap, shiny and shallow, and of course, short, often as short as a tweet. History is getting forgotten and risks being repeated. In contrast with a world in which human stories are increasingly disposable, the church that I was raised in taught me that human stories are sacred. And this is where I will put in a plug for Billy's book, Wow Moments, Stories of Grace, Wonder, and Synchronicity. So today, as I have reflected on my past, I also want to tell you about the work that I currently do with Church World Service. In this ongoing atmosphere of immigrants living in fear of deportation and children being separated from their family, my job includes working with the churches that are courageously willing to become sanctuary churches and with the sanctuary leaders who are brave enough to come out of the shadows and publicly go into sanctuary. So to give you some background about the concept of sanctuary, I want to tell you a story about a man named Eutropius. In the year 399 AD, this man, Eutropius, ran from the Roman palace in Constantinople into the nearby Great Church, as it was called, seeking sanctuary from his political enemies. He was greeted by the bishop, John Chrysostom, and granted the protection of the church. Eutropius had begun life as a slave and became a eunuch in the court of the Roman Emperor Theodosius. He rose through the ranks, and when Theodosius died, Eutropius was in the middle of the power struggle that followed. He arranged a strategic marriage for Theodosius' son Arcadius, who became emperor over the eastern half of the empire. And using rather dubious methods, Eutropius managed to fend off his political rivals. He became Arcadius' closest advisor, eventually having himself named Roman consul. But his enemies soon rallied and forced his removal, and he feared for his life with good reason. That was his situation when he sought sanctuary and was granted it by the bishop. The bishop's thoughts on this matter are preserved in two manuscripts. He used the situation to compare the misguided quest for worldly power with the steadfast mercy of the church. Addressing Eutropius directly, he stated, "The church, which you treated as an enemy, has opened her bosom to you." One of the ways Eutropius had treated the church as an enemy was by arranging for edicts that restricted the abilities of his political enemies to obtain sanctuary. But now he himself, known for his conniving and greed, had no other place to turn and was forced to seek refuge within the great church. Now, as you can imagine, this was not a particularly popular move with his congregation. Not only was Eutropius famous for being ruthless, and not only were there imperial officers with swords and spears surrounding the church demanding Eutropius' removal, but Chrysostom himself admitted in one of his sermons that providing Eutropius sanctuary may very well have been against the law that Eutropius himself had recently helped establish. But sanctuary was an established enough practice by that time that Emperor Arcadius commanded his soldiers to stand down and not interfere in that hallowed place. In the words of one historian summing up the situation, sanctuary provided opportunity for Eutropius to see the truth of life's fleeting glory and for the church to demonstrate that it was strong enough to protect even its most unpopular enemies against a fearsome army. The situation, unfortunately, did not end well. Eutropius tried to secretly escape from the church building, but was captured, exiled, and eventually killed. So while things didn't go so well for Eutropius, his story is an example of the fact that the church, big C, has practiced sanctuary extensively for the majority of its existence. For well over 1,000 years, sanctuary was standard church practice. So the Torah actually gives instructions for the creation of 6 cities of refuge for the Israelites. Numbers 35, which we read today, which I know that Numbers is not the most exciting book in the Bible, is one place where the Israelite cities of refuge are described. Now, these cities had a fairly narrow purpose. They were open to people who had killed another person unintentionally. Intentional or premeditated murder was given the death penalty, but unintentional murder, or even murder committed in the heat of the moment, made one eligible to escape to a city of refuge to avoid the nearest of kin, who had the sacred duty of redeeming the death by killing the murderer. The accidental murderer was only protected if he stayed within the city, and such murderers were only allowed to go home and leave sanctuary if the high priest in office died. Now, the New Testament also offers examples of sanctuary, though not explicit congregational sanctuary. The Gospels portray Jesus as someone who had no official credentials, but who demonstrated power and authority through his teachings, his healings, his miracles, and his bold actions. There are any number of gospel stories relevant to sanctuary, including the one we read this morning. In the book of Matthew, Jesus is in Capernaum, the home base of his ministry, where his early followers lived. He's in the house, which seems to be the house of Peter's family. And he's sitting at the table with his disciples, joined by tax collectors and sinners, social and moral outcasts. It's nothing like an official practice of sanctuary, but when the religious leaders see the lowly people with whom Jesus is associating and challenge Jesus on it, he offers his guests protection, material and spiritual refuge. He replied, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick have need. Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice." Now, this last bit about mercy, not sacrifice, is a quote from the prophet Hosea, a quote which the religious leaders would have known well. It is a bold and even comical move for Jesus to shoo them away and tell them to go study up on their own tradition and get enlightened on this thing called mercy. It's typical Jesus. To use the language of sanctuary, Jesus was a walking sanctuary. And everywhere he went, people who could find refuge nowhere else were drawn to him, and he welcomed them. Little children, those who sold their bodies to make a living, those like tax collectors who had sold out an empire. Jesus was a mobile sanctuary, and when he entered a house or a field or a boat, the winds shifted, and those who were previously at ease were on edge, and those who previously had no refuge were put at ease. These are the same winds that the Spirit blew at Pentecost after Jesus' death and resurrection, and created a multilingual, multicultural community defined by mercy and power of Jesus' ministry, which we simply call the church. The contemporary sanctuary movement has its origins in the refugee crisis of Central America in the 1980s, when an estimated 1 million people were fleeing their homelands of Guatemala, El Salvador, and Nicaragua for safety. It was an interfaith movement, including Catholics, Methodists, Presbyterians, Quakers, Jews, and Unitarian Universalists. Since 2000, the sanctuary movement has shifted largely from places of worship providing protection to refugees to those same places of worship providing shelter to immigrants in danger of deportation. I have the privilege in my work with Church World Service to get to work with the more than 40 sanctuary leaders in the United States who are currently staying in churches while they seek to avoid deportation so that they may be granted time to work towards legal solutions for their cases. Sanctuary leaders meet weekly by video conference to discuss their frustrations and concerns and to strategize about how to resolve their cases. I work with churches who are discerning whether they have the capacity to answer such a prophetic call. And I work directly with the 6 congregations in North Carolina who are providing physical sanctuary to be sure that their needs are met. It can be hard work, but I know that it is nothing compared to the work that these courageous leaders of this movement are doing by living day in and day out a sacred practice of resistance. Jim Corbett, a Quaker and a longtime advocate and supporter of Central American refugees, defines sanctuary as protective community with people whose basic human rights are being violated by government officials. He says that it incorporates prophetic witness into protective community. And he goes on to describe sanctuary as an identifying practice of a church that is fully ecumenical and an international community of faith-formed peoples that assume responsibility for the nonviolent protection of human rights. Today, I want to reflect upon the sanctuary movement, both within the church and beyond its walls, about both its past and also its future, and what it can mean for us personally. What can the sanctuary movement teach us about our call to live out our faith? Working with the sanctuary movement is not only difficult because of the emotional toll that one feels for the responsibility and safety and the well-being of others and their families, but also because it asks a lot of questions. It is both a lifting up of the moral imperative facing our global community and a motivation for exploring more deeply the question of what it means for you to be a Christian, a seeker, a friend, and a guest. What does it mean for your faith to be real and alive? When was the last time that your faith challenged you? That your faith became real, used in your day-to-day decision-making, thought processes, and way of approaching what lay before you? That's one of the many gifts of our religious tradition. We do not say that the truth is sealed. We believe that as we live into our faith changes and we are changed. That is why we call our faith a living faith. Sanctuary is and has always been a practice of merciful strength. Giving sanctuary is an act of resistance. It says no to the powers and principalities and their unjust laws, and yes to the hospitality of the heart. It is a form of radical welcome, and it demands evangelical courage to live out because there are possible legal ramifications for the congregations giving sanctuary and for the person who decides to enter into sanctuary. Any case can be used by the media, thereby calling attention to the plight of those who are completely vulnerable and being vilified as lawbreakers and thus condemned criminals. While examining the concept of sanctuary churches, I also want to reflect on this congregation as a sanctuary. Although I recognize that Asbury Memorial is not a sanctuary church in the literal sense of giving sanctuary to someone who's at risk for deportation, Asbury is a safe space for so many people. It is a sanctuary from the alienation and loneliness of modern life. Loneliness is the great epidemic of our time. People's isolation from one another in this country is causing failing health, spiritual breakdown, and even at times a grief so deep that it can lead to violence. Asbury for me was and is a community where people can be held, connected, remembered, and heard. In a world that isolates us and sets us in competition with one another, growing up in this community, I learned that we are all part of an interconnected web and we are not alone. Moreover, Asbury is also a sanctuary for people who need space to be themselves. It is a spiritual home for everyone, regardless of race, gender, ethnicity, sexual orientation, or gender identity. For so many people who have been hurt, shamed, or even abused by the church, Asbury is a safe spiritual space that makes room for all people and stands on the side of love, justice, and compassion. I want to end with a quote from Bishop John Chrysostom, whose congregation extended sanctuary to the Roman official Eutropius. And since we are in a sanctuary, we can receive it as if it was spoken to us. When you take refuge in a church, do not seek shelter in that place, but in the spirit of the place. The church is not wall and roof, but faith and life. Sanctuary is what the world needs right now. And people who are fed with the spirituality of sanctuary do not keep it to themselves. We go out across the country and into other countries and help transform our world. To a world of divisiveness, we answer with compassion and reconciliation. To a world of cynicism, we answer with grace and wonder. To a world of despair, we answer with hope and faith in the human capacity to transform. Amen.